Okay. So this evening, for your edification and entertainment, we have the simile of the cloth, the Wat Upama Sutta. So Wat is cloth, and Upama means the simile. And this particular sutta, one of the interesting things about this, which I'll bring up, because the whole purpose of these sutta classes, especially for those who one day become monks and nuns maybe, is to actually to give you an introduction to these suttas. And this one in particular, I'm going to begin it by reading a little bit of research done by Bhikkhu Anālaya, a very sort of smart German monk, who has compared some of these suttas which are in the Pali Pitaka with ones which are in the Agamas, the Mahayana canon, and to see that sometimes when you compare both of them, you can actually see that in the Pali they've added some things, taken up some things. In the other, the Agamas, the Mahayana canon, they've added some, taken out some. But when you put them together, you get a much clearer picture of what the original teachings were, you know, by combining. In this particular one, there's a very good little similar, the same sutta, but that's in the Ekotara, that's the same Sanghutta Nikaya. And in that one, it gives a much clearer picture of what's actually happening. It's not changing the Dhamma, but it's actually changing the people involved and exactly the circumstances in which the sutta were given. And it makes it much more interesting. And also, later on, once you have the background of why the sutta was actually said, it makes the whole thing much more interesting. And in this sutta, in particular, it uses the simile of a cloth, and you know, about when you're dyeing something, and brought up in a forest tradition where we used to dye our own clothes, it made very clear just how you have to make sure that piece of white cloth you start off with is really, really clean. If you try and dye it and there's any bit of imperfection in it, the dye is just really uneven and it looks awful. So for those people who used to dye their own cloth, which everybody would do in the time of the Buddha, this simile is very, very clear. These days, when you just get dyed cloth in the shop, it doesn't really make much sense. But in those days, this would be a very, very clear and very beautiful simile. And it just actually shows that when you take off the imperfections, you know, the Dhamma easily dyes the mind. And it's interesting, the word for actually dye is rajati. It has a similar meaning to delight. And simply because I think they have the idea that when you dye a cloth, it has nice bright colours, it's delightful to the eye, and have the same word as actually just to be delightful. And so the word is actually rajati. It's very similar like to raga, to lust. The two have a sort of a common root. And so the idea of dyeing, and pure dye means pure cloth means it takes the dye, the mind delights. It's a very important part. If you have a pure mind, a good mind, very few defilements, then it delights in the Dhamma, it delights in the breath, it delights in meditation, it delights in everything. Basically, the mind takes the Dhamma. And you get this beautiful mind as a result. And because of that, you have the confidence in the Buddha Dhamma, the Sangha. And they're also part of this sutta has become, because this is just the introduction here, you have this beautiful, the first time in the Majjhima, you have this beautiful sequence here, the causal sequence. You gain inspiration in the Dhamma, in the meaning, that's the atta, that should be the goal. Inspiration in the Dhamma, the inspiration comes up. And from inspiration, this pamuja, this gladness, sometimes this almost faith. And when you are glad, you have pity, rapture born in you. One is rapturous, the body becomes tranquil, really still and peaceful. And sometimes, and for one whose body is tranquil, you feel sukha. And one who feels sukha, the mind becomes still, becomes concentrated in samadhi. This whole sequence. In this particular one, it starts with delighting in the Dhamma and its the meaning. And because you delight in that, you get gladness. Gladness, you get this piety, and piety makes the body just really peaceful and still. You get this beautiful happiness, and that's the beautiful breath, that delight inside, and then the mind becomes very still. You get samadhi and jhana. this whole process here. And it's not as if you make this process happen, this is cause and effect, cause and effect. And we come across that after. That's a very beautiful part. And this actually reoccurs so many times throughout the suttas. And then it actually starts to also introduce for the third time the four Brahma Viharas. And we'll go into that a bit as we go through. And of course we always come across one interesting little statement. And the interesting statement on here is that he understands thus. There is this. There is the inferior. There is the superior. And beyond this, there is an escape from all of this whole field of perception. And when you know and see thus, you are an arahat. Now those are those little statements which people really love. You know, the intellectuals and say, this is like a Zen state. What the heck does that mean? There is this, there is the inferior, there is the superior, and escape from the whole lot. Da da da. So wait and see. All be answered soon. So that's the introduction to the sutta. So here we go. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namasami. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, a blessed one was living at Sarvati in Jeta's Grove, Anatta Pindika's Park. There he addressed the monks thus. Monks, venerable sir, they replied, and the blessed one said this, but. We're just going to add a little bit more. The introduction. This is from Analia's, this is his draft. It's actually a book now. Another clarifying instance comes from the same Ekotara, that's Anguttara Agama, this time from the Chinese parallel to the Watupama Sutta, this one over here. The Pali version treats a set of mental imperfections coming soon, followed by describing the gain of perfect confidence in the three refuges or the three jewels, before turning to the development of the Brahma Viharas and the gain of liberation. And in the middle of all this, if you read it before, and I'll point it out when we get to it, the Watupama Sutta brings in a passage about taking delicious food. According to this passage, for a monk of such virtue, even taking delicious food will not become an obstruction. This passage comes a little surprising at this point, in between the gain of perfect confidence in the three jewels and the development of the divine abidings, the Brahma Viharas. And its implication remains somewhat obscure in the discourse. Basically, does it belong? And the Pali commentary explains, blah, blah, blah. But the similar passage also occurs in the Anguttara Nikaya, the Mahayana Anguttara Agama parallel, where it, however, comes after the gain of liberation at the end of an otherwise firmly similar exposition. In other words, it comes at the very end. And the reason is this. Unlike the Watupama Sutta we're going to read out now, the beginning part of the Ekotara Agama, it's similar sutta in the Mahayana discourses, that discourse provides some background to the setting of the discourse, which is why I'm putting this in now, reporting the arrival of the Brahmin Sundarika Bharadwaja. So in the Mahayana version, at this point, the Brahmin Bharadwaja, Sundarika Bharadwaja comes in, and his arrival formed the occasion for the Buddha to deliver this discourse. And the same Brahmin occurs in the final part of the Pali and the Chinese version, questioning the Buddha about purification through bathing the sacred rivers. The Chinese version describes that this Brahmin felt quite confident of his own spiritual purity compared to the Buddha. In other words, he thought he was more pure than the Buddha because he only took simple food, just like we take here. Okay, so this is a wonderful thing if you think that we eat too well. This Brahmin thought he was spiritually more pure than the Buddha because he only took simple food, while the Buddha sometimes partook of succulent and rich food. The Buddha had become aware of this thought of the Brahmin, which led him to deliver the present discourse. With this background information in mind, the passage on taking delicious food found in both versions becomes more meaningful, since it was just such taking of delicious food by the Buddha which had caused the Brahmin to underestimate the degree of purification the Buddha had reached. Hence, by pointing out that eating delectable food does not constitute an obstruction, the Buddha directly replied to the misconception of the Brahmin, a misconception that had motivated the Buddha to deliver the entire discourse in the first place. And once you have that background, it makes it much easier to understand the sutta. So you can imagine, this Brahmin had come in to the Jeta Grove to see the Buddha, and the Buddha had obviously seen that he was very pure because he had simple food, and these monks had just too much delicious food, and he thought that because of the delicious food that was going to be defilement. But the Buddha said, no, these are the defilements, this is how it's overcome. And he said, once these are overcome, it doesn't matter if it's delicious food or not delicious food. And that becomes the whole purpose of this sutta. And that's very relevant for us, because obviously sometimes we get the same complaint. We don't eat one meal a day here, we eat one feast a day. But if someone comes and thinks that, this is a sutta for them. So here we go now. Back to the sutta, paragraph 2. Monks, suppose a cloth were defiled and stained, and a dye dipped it in some dye or other, whether blue, yellow, or red, or carmine. It would look poorly dyed and impure in colour. Why is that? Because of the impurity of the cloth. So too, when the mind is defiled, an unhappy destination may be expected. Monks, suppose the cloth were pure and bright, and a dye dipped it in some dye or other, whether blue or yellow or red or carmine, it would look well dyed and pure in colour. Why is that? Because of the purity of the cloth. So too, when the mind is undefiled, a happy destination may be expected. So it's just using that simile which I was trying to explain earlier, that even the slightest, especially when I was dyeing cloth, a slight bit of oil or grease on that cloth, and it just would not take the dye properly. So I used to spend a long time making sure that that piece of white cloth was washed, and usually with some detergent, really washed, and all the detergent ran out. And once it was clean, you looked after it really carefully so no one with mucky hands could get their hands on it, otherwise it would mess up all the dyeing. So you had to have a very pure cloth to do some dyeing. And of course, what does it mean by a pure cloth in terms of the mind? What monks are the imperfections that defile the mind, like grease and grime would defile the cloth? And these are those defilements which we talked about, which were in the earlier suttas. Covetousness and unrighteous greed, just like desire, lust, is an imperfection that defiles the mind. Ill will, anger, resentment, contempt, insolence, envy, avarice, deceit, fraud, obstinacy, rivalry, conceit, arrogance, vanity, negligence, is an imperfection that defiles the mind. And I believe when Ajahn Brahmani did that sutta before I was over in Sydney, the Anangana Sutta, without blemishes, that was mentioned, that list was mentioned there, and I think he would have talked about that. Is that correct? He didn't. Didn't go into detail. Okay, well, many of these things, covetousness is abhija, and as I mentioned before, the abhija is a synonym for the first hindrance. Because if you read in Pali the suttas, that sometimes for the first hindrance, its most common form is kama chanda, with sensory desire. But sometimes, about 40% of the time, a quite considerable number of times, the first hindrance is called loke abhija. And this is what we have here. And they got covetousness there. So covetousness means that, you know, when you know you see somebody's mug and you want that mug for yourself. You see somebody's jacket and you want a jacket like that. In other words, you want other people's property. You covet it. But it's obviously, this word means something much different than that. It means just basically sensual desire again. And have unrighteous greed, which is an interesting idea. What does it mean by unrighteous greed? Is some greed righteous? May all beings be happy and well. That's being pretty greedy. Most people would just be happy if one person was happy and well, maybe two or three. But that's righteous greed. Greed for the happiness and well-being of all beings. It's just an example. So this I should think as righteous, in a sense, not really greed. Greed, again, is not quite the right word. Like righteous wanting. Yes?
Beings that have no blemishes,
yeah?
But then they function in the world, you know, and they reach out and have water and have food. But it's just like a process of life, but without any kind of disturbance in the mind. How can that function?
Oh, no, of course, there must be disturbance in the mind. Whenever there's any desire, there's disturbance in the mind. But what is the desire for? It is for the happiness and well-being of all sentient beings. Just like I mentioned in one of those talks, when an arahat takes a rest, he takes a nap, a sleep, not for his own benefit, but for the happiness and well-being of all sentient beings. Remember that talk I gave some time ago?
Rebuke tomorrow.
Sorry?
It was a rebuke tomorrow.
Rebuke tomorrow, yeah. So when Mara saw the Buddha, and saw the Buddha resting, he said, ah, that's being lazy. He's having a rest during the middle of the day. See? That's just sloth and torpor. That's, you're supposed to be the Buddha enlightened. See, what are you doing that for? And the Buddha's reply, I'm taking a nap for the benefit of all sentient beings. When you think about it, it's obviously correct, because he's looking after his health and well-being. So he could actually teach and have more energy afterwards. So that's actually why people with no desire for their own benefit, they don't see a difference between themselves and others. Whatever they do, they take a glass of water for the benefit of all sentient beings.
Sajan, to really understand the impact of desire, it seems like there has to be like an understanding of the motive behind it.
Yes, that's right, and the motive behind it. For the arahat, I often wondered that. What motivates an arahat? What keeps them going? And it's the four bhamviharas, four divine abodes, out of loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, or equanimity. That's what drives them.
So that seems really noble. It doesn't seem like just because of the desire that one would really fault that.
No, because that's why it's called righteous greed. Thank you. So we came round to where we started from. So thank you for taking us back to the main point. And obviously, ill will and anger, we all know that. But ill will is a nice word too, because why a pardon? Because it's not just ill will to a person. It's very easy to have ill will towards others, we all know that. But we also have ill will towards ourselves, which is a defilement. I'm really awful, I made a big mistake, I shouldn't have done that. And of course that ill will towards oneself is like guilt, punishing oneself. And of course sometimes that means, oh, I'm not good enough. I don't deserve to get jhanas, I don't deserve to become enlightened. And that type of ill will towards oneself is amazingly common. Yes.
Like the word ill will sounds like a ill type of craving, but I thought ill will is kind of like a mental state,
yeah.
Not necessarily having a craving, which is like a...
Yeah, it's just wills ill on other people.
So what's ill, like what's the Pali word, and how do we... Like what's the ill will? Is it a craving or is it a state of mind?
This is just one word, vayapada. Yeah.
And that, does that word mean a particular type of...
No, just apada means like sick, not well. So it's a particular type of, you know, wanting someone to be, you know, I don't like you, I hope you don't sleep tonight, I hope you get sick, I hope you drop dead, I hope you sort of... Or is that famous curse, may you be infested, may your armpits be infested with the fleas of 1,000 camels. That's actually an Arab curse.
Does it refer to a craving, like an ill-type craving, or just a mental state, like
it
doesn't necessarily have a...
It is a type of craving, but it's a craving which creates a mental state. Once you have that craving, then how can I bring that about? So you say rotten things, do rotten things to other people. So that's what that ill will really is. that's pretty easy. So ill will towards other people, ill will towards yourself, it also means that will to prevent you being happy, prevent you being peaceful, prevent you from being still in meditation, preventing yourself from being enlightened. That's actually wishing oneself well. You know what happens sometimes, a big middle of a retreat, you think, oh, I'm really hopeless. Gee, I've been meditating for 6 weeks, all these wonderful sort of services provided, and all these people bringing me delicious food, and I haven't got anywhere yet, I'm hopeless, I'm terrible. So that's ill will too. Be careful of that. Yes?
There's a sutta where a holy ascetic came up to the Buddha, and the Buddha gave him teaching about in the scene is just the scene.
That's right, Bahya. Little computer, yeah.
So, can you think of the blemishes of the mind as additions to that level of direct, still perception?
Remember, if it's in the seeing, it's just the seeing. In the hear, there's just the heard, and the cognized, the known, just the known. That's just the knower, no more doing. That's a hard thing to do. All those people had jhanas beforehand, that's another story. But here, it's just focusing on just one particular defilement, which is the ill will.
Are these aspects of doing much?
Oh, of course they are. If you didn't do this, there wouldn't be any doing. Resentment, you have to do resentment, the next one. You know what resentment is? Just I really, really resent. Who can I resent today? I resent all those other senior monks. They don't have to come out on a Saturday evening to give talks and just talk to you guys. They have it really easy. I have to do all the work. I really resent all these monks. They just eat the same food as I do, but they don't have to stay behind talking to people all the time. Oh, I resent all this. It's so easy. That's what resentment is. You know, you just that's really rotten, and it's a. So sometimes if you have working in the kitchen and somebody doesn't turn up for the chores and you think, bastard, don't they know we've got to do all this work? Well, that's resentment. That's a hindrance. The opposite of that is this wonderful sense of kindness, compassion. Great, they didn't come to help with the cleanup afterwards. That means I can do more, I can get more merit, I am so lucky. So, remember, don't get into that resentment of, you know, they didn't come today, they're the lazy bums. Yeah?
One thing I've noticed in myself from living in cultures where women are really treated very
badly. Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, repeatedly, and you just take it because that's the culture.
You've got no choice, yeah.
But what I see is it does build resentment.
Yeah.
And then I notice that comes up in the...
That's right, and it's tough, because that's why it's good to sort of... Yeah, I mean, it's if that wasn't sort of not coming to the clean-up was not an invitation for you to make sure that other people can make more good karma. So if you're on the clean-up tomorrow, say, out of compassion for the other people who were in the clean-up with me, I will not go today for the clean-up so that other people can make more karma. that's not a wise thing, otherwise none of you will go. So we do our duties, and the same with, you know, the cause of resentment. There may be a good cause there, you know, the inequity and not, you know, people not putting their weight, you know, the unevenness. So, but we don't get to the point of resentment. We just say, there's a problem there. Okay, Matt, you should come to the kitchen to do the clean up. I know you always do. That's why I don't pick on anybody who's the problem. So it is a problem, resentment. But, you know, if there's a way of fixing it, fix it. If there's not, just have to take it. Don't be resentful. And contempt. So obviously that's when looking down, that's a type of pride. You're contemptuous. And, you know, all these lay people coming here who think they can understand Dhamma. You know, when you're not sort of in brown robes, and who do you think you are? And sometimes people think that way, you know. So there's some Sangha members, they really look down with contempt upon the lay community. Or you've got, you know, like some Asian monks have contempt for the Western monks, or the other way around. That's a stupid way of looking at things. So contempt is obviously something you see coming up. It's a defilement. And insolence. You know what instances? You know the first two rules of this monastery? First rule of the monastery is? Ajahn's always right, yes. And the second rule is? If the Ajahn's wrong, go back to rule number one. Anything else is insolence. You know what instance is? I mean, it can be to anybody. Like, you know, somebody sort of comes up, can you give me a hand? So, piss off, you know, just stupid. I'm not going to give you a hand. So, you know, the insolence, you know, it's just the wrong speech, the way we sort of speak badly towards one another. So, to be kind words to one another. To be courteous. Yes, madam. Yeah.
You know how we say things are skillful if it leads to nirvana and
that's right, yeah.
It doesn't? So it's like a functional definition of what a hindrance
good.
Is.
Yes.
The jhana. So here, I was wondering, like, how do you know if something is a blemish or not? Because we know that, okay, there's good states of mind, like loving kindness, compassion, and then bad states, like resentment and all that. But how do you know that is one thing is a balance or another? Is it the same thing as
One way.
What prevents
you from
meditating?
Exactly. It's a hindrance. It's a hindrance, like instance a hindrance, because it stains the mind. And if you've had a real act of insolence, you try and meditate afterwards, the mind won't take the peace, it won't take the joy. It's like the cloth won't take the dye.
So is it like anything, so if you remove the defilements, then jhanas happen
easily? Exactly.
So
that's right. If you take away the defilements, the hindrances, then there's nothing between you and the jhanas, it just happens naturally. So that these are all the causes of not getting deep meditation, not getting insight. That's why the defilements are similar to the cloth, that's why the cloth doesn't take the dye. Doesn't take the delight, doesn't take the insight, doesn't take the peace. You know what it's like sometimes, you know, you're meditating, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work, and you say, what's happening? And sometimes it's what you've been thinking before, sometimes you might have some covetousness, some greed, some ill will, some anger, resentment, contempt or insolence or some of these other things. That's why the Buddha's pointing this out. These stain the cloth. Yeah.
And positive emotions, let's say kindness, so it's still kind of like an emotion. So are those not defilements, but good because it helps, because they're needed for, let's say, jhana?
That's right. They don't distort the mind, and also they don't, in particular here, they don't make the mind impure. So you know, you do an act of service, of kindness, you work all afternoon, and for service of others. And if you do that without contempt or without sort of thinking, why do I have to do this? But you do it just beautifully, willingly, as an act of service. You try and meditate afterwards, and it's beautiful. You get some nice meditation. So you can actually find whether your mind takes the Dharma, takes the meditation, if it takes the mind, takes the Dharma, it's not a defilement. And of course you all know that if service done in the right way, kindness done in the right way, those sorts of things actually, they do, you can see very clearly, they improve the meditation almost immediately. Therefore they're not defilement. That's how you, I'm using the simile of the cloth here. And that's why I want to focus on that particular simile, for this is the heart of the sutta. If it's a defilement, the mind doesn't take the dye. If it is a defilement, if it's not a defilement, the mind takes the dye. Yeah.
Oh,
it's okay. Okay, yeah. No.
Are you defining upanaha as contempt?
Okay, now this, there's many different versions of what that word might mean.
Because in the Gloss that I read, because I'm looking at the first three, Uvaya Prayata and the Kroha, those three seem to be exacerbating from the ill will.
Yes, just like
those three seem to go together.
Indeed, they're different types of ill will.
Yeah, but I think that they're, like, they define it as hostility.
Yeah, can be, yeah.
Can be,
taken to that degree, where it's colder, and if it's repeated and repeated, becomes hostility.
Yep. That's why that because many of these words, ill will, anger, is pretty obvious. Some of the others are pretty obvious, but some of these words are only used once or twice in the whole sutras, and it's hard to find out exactly what they mean.
Can I read the glass?
No.
Okay. because it goes into the belligerence and resentment to that extent.
Yeah. Good, excellent, yeah. That's fine. You had one? Question?
You know, when one does a kind act, a good deed, you know, there's still will there and desire. So,
yes.
You know, like, I get in the aggregate of that process of will and desire. It's just like, as I understand it, it's that identification's personality, identification with it, that's the problem. But is it the kindness or the soft emotions that go with that service that is more closer to the function of will and desire without an identity with it?
Indeed, it's much closer to it. It's selfless service. So you know you're not going to get anything out of this. You don't get a medal for at the end of the year. For we don't give medals to the anagarikas for service in the kitchen beyond what was expected or asked of you. What do they say for when they have these medals in the army? For service beyond... Sorry? Beyond the call of duty, yes. So if you take out the rubbish beyond the call of duty, because it's not your job, you don't get medals, so it's not coming from ego.
Is seeing will and desire as process more clearly, that seems to be part of what freedom's about?
It's seeing those cause and effect. So when you see cause and effect, you want to make sure that it's the causes which produce the beautiful effects, rather than the ugly effects. So somehow you have to find out whether it's a good cause or not. You see what the effect is, and if the cloth doesn't take the dye, that's a defilement. If the cloth does take the dye, that's not a defilement.
What is the dye?
The dye is the Dhamma, so you enjoy the Dhamma. It's just compassion. It takes compassion easily. It takes loving kindness. It takes peace. It takes meditation, stillness. All those things it takes very easily. And if you resist those things, it doesn't take. It must be like, you know, sometimes you talk to people about Dhamma and just they get very upset and angry. They really resist it. They don't take at all. Why is that? Because they've got many of these defilements of the mind. They're just not ready for it. So to be able to even be here and listen to a sutta talk, it means your minds are already just pretty clear of defilements. Okay, so you've got the other things. Envy is pretty easy. Avarice, deceit. Deceit and fraud, that's actually pretty clearly defined, especially in the terms for Sangha. And deceit and fraud, you know, that's actually just means to get our livelihood by sort of fraudulent means. Acting like a doctor, deceiving you, that, you know, I can, if you take my holy water, I'll cure all of your cancers and all of your diseases. You know, and people charge for that sometimes. That's fraudulent. And obstinacy, that's when people... That's tumba. That's very easily understood. That's, you know, when people have just won't be told. But we've all got some obstinacy. So, rivalry, the conceit... We all know what the conceit means. That's mana. And mana is, you know, when three conceits. The first conceit is when you think you're better than everybody else. That's the usual conceit we understand in English. You think you're worse than other people, that's still conceit. And the other third conceit is I'm the same as everybody else. The three conceits. All wrong. And it's great, because I always thought there's only one conceit, just I'm better than everybody else. But just thinking you're worse than everybody else, that's a type of conceit. It's a measuring of yourself. And the other conceit is we're all the same. That's the conceit which lies at the heart of the United States Declaration of Independence. Is it self? It's a self-evident truth that all men are created equal. We're not equal. We're not better, we're not the same. Don't even mention women. Or gays. Or animals. Or other sentient beings. So anyway, see, that is sort of a fundamental flaw. So it's not the same, not equal. We're not sort of better or not worse. Different. It's like that great, remember those of you who saw the great religious movie, The Life of Brian? And when they asked Brian for some wisdom, and his wisdom was, "You are all different." Remember that one? And what was the answer? One person put his hand up and says, "I'm not." I thought that was funny. Very good. I thought it was funny too. Anyway, where we go, that's conceit. And arrogance is atimana. And ati, when you have a prefix, that means that real excessive conceit. That means, well, you not just think you're better, I mean you really are way above everybody else. But it also means you're way below. I'm just the most worst ajahn in our whole of the forest tradition. I'm terrible. That's also atimana. I mean, it's an exaggeration of conceit. Vanity. What's the word for vanity, though? You got one there?
Vanity,
mada. Mada. Oh, mada. That's actually not mada. That's almost, vanity. They have a couple of vanities. One is yobana mada. Yobana means youth. That's where we get the word yob from in English. It means it is. Let's call some youth. Yobana, same word. And it means like the vanity, almost like the stupidity, intoxication, of youth. That's when you're young, like you're only 23. How old are you, 20? 24. And you think, you can do anything. I'm fit, I'm healthy, the life's going to go on forever. And that's like a madness. That's where the madder comes from. The madness comes from that word as well. It's an intoxication, just like you're drunk on youth. And the other one is the intoxication of health. Because once you're healthy, you think, this is the natural state, I'm always going to be healthy. You don't realise it's passing away every second. So that's the meaning of vanity there. And last one, pamada, negligence, an imperfection of the powers of mind. So exactly what those are, and those are just examples. They don't cover all possible defilements of mind. There are others which aren't mentioned in there. So they're descriptive rather than prescriptive, as they say in English. But the point is, whenever there's an imperfection, it means the mind won't be able to take the peace, the kindness, the Dharma, nothing. But when those are gone, like a beautiful, clean piece of cloth, it easily takes the Dharma, it easily takes meditation.
Is there a relationship
between pamada and mada? Pamada is with everything. Because that's why the last words of the Buddha, apamādena, so no pamada, so we've no work towards
it. Both forms of madness.
It's pamada in a sense. It's the pat word, pat prefix in front of mada means like extreme.
So in the negative terms, if you think about it in terms of prisons, the loud mind, because this whole suit is based on dying the cloth, which is to purify the. Purify
the
defilements. And in someone who's negligent,
these
last two are quite interesting. The last one being
Interesting. Yeah, that's a very
deep
one. That's one of the big ones.
Yeah, but it seems that the last one, the people who have that, as opposed to the people who are here, for example, allow their minds, in fact, indulge their minds to go through the defilements. They don't even think about it. While most of us are at least hopeful.
We're trying, yeah. Most of the time. Even if it's some of the time. A little bit of time. Indeed, yeah.
So that's crazy.
It's crazy, yeah. That's why that's the last word of the Buddha. I mean, don't be negligent.
Mm-hmm. It's a very hard, it's very deep, that one, negligence. I always see it come up, and this is the first time I think I have.
That's right, yes. Yes.
What is the cause of being negligent or allowing the defilements versus having that
You'd probably call it Awija.
Illusion?
Yeah.
But sometimes, you know, you're more enthusiastic to not fall silent, but
Yeah, but the thing is, you don't really think it's defilements, you think it's good. You don't understand. Anyway, that just like the cloth, even when it's washed, this is my take on this, it's got no impurities, it'll take the dye, but eventually the cloth will always get dirty again. So there's only a temporary freedom from the defilements is meant here. So that knowing that covetous and unrighteous greed is an imperfection defiles the mind, a monk, a nun, layperson abandons it. Knowing that ill will, anger, resentment, contempt, insolence, envy, avarice, deceit, fraud, obstinacy, rivalry, conceit, arrogance, vanity, negligence are imperfections that defile the mind, a meditator abandons it. Now, it doesn't mean you abandon it forever, it means you get rid of it for a while. I'll just go on to the next paragraph then for questions. When a monk or meditator, nun, has known that covetousness and righteousness, greed, is an imperfection of the mind, that defiles the mind and has abandoned it, when a bhikkhu has known these other things are imperfections that defile the mind and they have abandoned it, then they acquire unwavering confidence in the Buddha. Thus, the Blessed One is accomplished, fully enlightened, perfect in true knowledge and conduct, sublime, knower of the worlds, incomparable, leader of persons to be tamed, teacher of gods and humans, enlightened, blessed. He acquires unwavering confidence in the Dhamma thus. The Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One, visible here and now, immediately effective, inviting inspection, onward leading, to be experienced by the wise from themselves. He acquires unwavering confidence in the Sangha thus. The Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples is practicing the good way, the straight way, the true way, the proper way, that is, the four pairs of persons, the eight types of individuals. The Son of the Blessed One's disciples is worthy of gifts, worthy of hospitality, worthy of offerings, worthy of reverential salutation, the unsurpassed field of merit for the world. And of course you all know that in Pali, when it says, unwavering confidence in the Buddha thus, the Blessed One is accomplished, that means, Itipiso bhagava alahang samma sambuddho vija charana sampano sukato lokavido nutaro pusa dhamma sarati sata deva manasaran buddho bhagava. That's paragraph 5. Paragraph 6. Engraving confidence in the Dhamma thus, the Dhamma is well proclaimed. Suakato bhagavata dhammo sanditiko akaliko ehi pasiko pranayiko pachatang viditabo vinyuhi ti. Acquires unwavering confidence in the Sangha thus, the Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples practicing good way. Supatipanno bhagavato sāvakasaṅgho, utupatipanno bhagavato sāvakasaṅgho, yāyapatipanno bhagavato sāvakasaṅgho, sāmicipatipanno bhagavato sāvakasaṅgho. That's the first one. Yadi dāṅ fitāri purisāyugāni atta purisapukala etha bhagavato sāvakasaṅgho. And that gets down to worthy of gifts, ahunayo, pahunayo, dakino, anjali, karanyo. And lastly, Anuttarang Punyaketang Lokasa, the unsurpassed field of merit in the world. So that those chants we do are not just made up, they're actually part of the suttas, and this comes up again many, many times. So those chants you do, if you do those chants, you know where they come from. Yeah?
To abandon these things, is that based on a knowing of the perception of the painfulness, those defilements?
To know the defilements and know that your cloth will never get clean when those will never take the dye when those defilements are there. So it has some insight, some wisdom power. And then how do you overcome them, even temporarily? Eightfold path.
But Ajahn, as a motivator,
yeah.
Isn't it that it's to do with being free of the suffering of these things?
That's one way of doing it, free of suffering. The other way is actually for the happiness of it. Those ones who just want to find out the truth, they want to find out what's going on, whether it's suffering or not. So there's many motivators.
But if you want to find out truth, you must, I guess, delight or find pleasure
in truth.
Yeah.
So it's another form of happiness, for sure. But some people just are motivated to end suffering. Some people are motivated to find truth. Some people, like I said about Nanda last week, is motivated to get nice bimbos up in heaven. That was last week's. You have to listen to last week's talk to find out the meaning of that.
Motivated for pleasure or happiness.
Yeah.
Just going one step at a time to get more and more refined happiness.
Exactly, yeah.
So it's come down to sort of like finding a certain kind of delight.
This way, yeah. Which is what motivates most people. Find delight, but to find sometimes the search for truth is sometimes even more important than the search for happiness. Okay. So this is when these things have been abandoned for a little while, abandon it, then you get this unwavering confidence in the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha. And that is also known as, when you have unwavering confidence in the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, that is also known as being what? Sotapanna, streamlined, yeah. So having abandoned these things, you know, you actually, this is where you get the wisdom, experiential wisdom. My goodness, what do I want to keep this thing for anyway? Yeah. Individuals. Okay, the four persons, the pairs, are number one, the stream winner, and the one on the path of being a stream winner. That's the first pair. And the second pair is those who are once returner and on the path of being a once returner. And the third is one who is an anagami, a non returner, on the path of being a non returner. And also the last is one who is being an arahat or on the path of being an arahat. That's the four pairs, otherwise meaning eight. And they're worthy of gifts, worthy of hospitality, of offerings, reverential salutation, unsurpassed field of merit for the world. So if you want to make some merit to get the biggest bang for your bucks, as they say in the stock market, you invest in the Arya Sangha. What about the Dhamma? It says, well proclaimed by the Blessed One. I actually lingered on that a lot, because it's Suakata, means it's well expounded. So what I say by that is, you know, the Buddha was a very clear teacher. Didn't teach in sort of in riddles. So it's clearly expounded, well expounded. In other words, he said what he meant what he said. That's why you read this stuff, you read the whole lot of it, it's very clear what the message is, it's consistent, it's very well put forward. Yes?
Just for a minute, you know, before meaning faith, it says, so, you see, knowing covetousness and righteousness with it is an imperfection, knowing that these things are an imperfection at the heart of the mind, and then they abandon it, and once they abandon it, then that's right away when they get faith. So, and
You've had a lot of suffering, and here's one person who's actually talking about suffering, not talking about, you know, what's going to happen after you die in some heaven, or who created the world, or, you know, about sin and how to get out of sin and all that sort of stuff. It's something which is right for your personal experience. So that's one form of faith. At least the Buddha's actually, you know, teaching people about their daily lives. And it could also be for this particular aspect here, this particular context, is actually seeing that all these things are defilements, and when you abandon these defilements, then your mind takes a dive. Meditation is easy, understanding Dhamma is easy, joy is easy, because it takes a dive. That gives you a lot of faith and confidence. This actually is a path which works. And of course, I keep on saying again and again, you can hear all the talks in the world, read all the books in the world. But what really gives you the confidence and faith is actually when you put it into practice and it works. My goodness, it actually works. I'm actually more peaceful. My mind takes a dive. I can actually meditate now. I understand all of this. You know, your mind's taking a dive, and that really starts giving you a lot of faith and confidence. Now, paragraph 8, you get to one of the nicest parts of this. When he has given up, expelled, released, abandoned, and relinquished, and again in Pali, when the English would say one word, there's the possibility of saying five. It's as if someone's looked in the thesaurus and see all the different words you can say for meaning the same thing and put every one of those combinations, permutations in. So it doesn't mean different things. It just means when you've given up, in part, or the imperfections of the mind in part, you consider thus. I am possessed of unwavering confidence in the Buddha, and you gain inspiration in the meaning, inspiration in the Dhamma. Now the meaning here is like the word atta, and the Dhamma is the Dhamma. And it was, again, I mentioned this in many talks, Bhikkhu Bodhi, just in his introduction, I think, to the Mahanidana Sutta. You know, he gave this beautiful simile, which, you know, to me, just all the lights went on in the brain, in the mind. So this is what the Dharma means in the Atta. What are you experiencing now? Where it comes from, its origin, the underlying laws, that's the Dhamma. So working back from the phenomena of your experience to the, you know, the why, where it comes from, that's called Dhamma. And the consequence, where it's leading to, what's going to happen afterwards, that's the Atta. That's it, that's what has here, the meaning. So in the sense of what's the meaning of your life, what's the goal of your life, where's your life going towards, that's your meaning. And it's meaning here in that sense, the goal of all of this, where does it all lead to? And these always leads to freedom, enlightenment, peace. So you get inspiration that this path is going to lead to this amazing stuff. It's going to lead to peace, freedom, happiness, joy. And you get inspired by that. And you also get inspired by the Dhamma. You understand how it all works, where it all comes from, you know, the underlying laws of nature, of the mind. So that's the difference between these two, always go together. They're called antonyms. You know, the two always like light and dark, night and day, tall and short. This, the Dhamma and the Atta. The Dhamma is the where it all comes from, the laws, the principles, and the Atta is actually how it all works out, where it leads to. So, yep.
Here it says to abandon in part. Are there the three perfections of the stream winner?
Yes, yeah. So you're a stream winner. You haven't totally abandoned everything, but I would actually say temporarily.
So the things that are abandoned, they're wiped out.
Oh yeah, they're wiped out temporarily. They come back again. You're a stream winner. So you haven't totally done all the job yet. You just temporarily abandoned some of these defilements. So the cloth is temporarily clean, so it can take the dye. But those defilements will come back again later because you haven't done the full work yet.
To sort of like distinguish like an Aryan from, say, someone who's experienced jhana but isn't an Aryan, wouldn't that mean that what has been abandoned has to be reversible, like the perfection of view and things like that?
Oh, yes, yeah. So what has been abandoned, which is reversible, is ill will, anger, resentment, contempt, insolence, even negligence. What's been abandoned there is reversible. So what, in the context of this sutta, is reversible? Obviously your right view is not reversible. That's there forever. It's a streamer. But anyway, now, so once you get this inspiration, and actually the word is actually Veda. That's where they get the word Vedas from. It's supposed to be inspiring verses. So it's Atta Veda and Dhamma Veda. And the inspiration. Here's beautiful inspiration in the Dhamma. Just like you get, sometimes you hear a really good talk, and it really inspires you. Or see something, someone acting just so selflessly, and it really inspires you. And from that inspiration, automatically, you don't have to make this happen, it just happens as a natural consequence. That's in another sutta. Gladness connected with the Dhamma arises. So this is not just gladness connected with sensory pleasures. Oh, no, what did we have for lunch today? We had pizza for lunch today. Oh, that makes me so glad. I had pizza. No, it's, you know, it's this gladness toward the Dhamma, which is different. When you get this gladness, this pramudya, then pity is born in you. And this is actually, sometimes you understand what pity is, and this is natural, it just happens. And when you have this pity, the body becomes tranquil, which means you can sit for long periods of time. It's not this restlessness of the body. So some of you, you know, you want to say, I can't sit very long. Now, do I have to do yoga? Do I have to sort of do stretching exercises? Yeah, those things help. But, you know, what really helps is the piti. And there's this beautiful sense of joy that just makes the body just so soft, so light, and you can sit for long periods with no aches and pains, just the joy. And of course, a form of piti. Remember, I once just I was talking about this actually to Mudito, because he had the flu, and I was telling him that once when I had the flu as a student, I got my stereo system and I put on Jimi Hendrix record, and I got so much piti, you know, not piti connected to the Dhamma, but connected to sensory pressures. So my flu disappeared, my body was tranquil. I know, it's just amazing to actually to know that happens. You get some joy, some piti, and that really starts to stop sicknesses and stop aches and pains. So you can actually sit long if you get piti connected to the Dhamma. So you get this beautiful tranquility, the body sitting there, just this, no aches and pains, and then the body vanishes. And the next thing, and from that tranquility of the body, it's also sometimes, that's the kaya prasadi, it's also chitta prasadi as well. And then you feel this beautiful sukha. Now they've got pleasure here. Great pleasure, but it's not sort of the pleasures of the body or the pleasures of those five senses. It's a pleasure of tranquility. And that's actually the sukha. And it's important to see that pleasure there, because this is the next word, next connection is one phrase I often mention, and here it is, sukhino chittang samadhiyati. In one who has pleasure, the mind becomes concentrated. And not concentrated, but still. That's partly what that says. Sukhino chittang samadhiyati. Literally means from happiness, that type of happiness, the mind becomes still. Gets into samadhi, meditation. And that's such an important thing to just stress there. You don't get stillness through suffering. And if you're not having a good time in meditation, you never get to samadhi. The proximate cause of samadhi is this beautiful happiness in the mind. You're sitting, oh, this is so delightful, the delightful breath. Oh, delightful nimittas. That is the cause of samadhi. Which is why I often encourage people, please develop that delight. And if you're having a good time in meditation, don't think something must be wrong. I'm enjoying myself, I'll get attached. Ah, I'm doing something wrong. No, this is the path here. All this happiness here. Look at it again. You've got gladness connected with the Dhamma and the result. Rapture is born. The body tranquility, feeling pleasure, sukha, and then samadhi jhana. It's a pretty sort of nice practice, the different types of happiness and pleasure. So this is a very pleasurable path. So if you're suffering, what type of meditation are you doing? Second noble truth. You lost the plot. So you start to get happy and peaceful, you're just letting go. This is what's supposed to happen. And one great way of doing it is just inspired by the Dhamma. Yeah.
Does that imply that lack of confidence is one of the causes of all these defilements?
Well, yeah, it's one of those vicious circles or cycles. You haven't got confidence, so you get defilements, which means you haven't got confidence, and so you just get into this rut. But every now and again, someone inspires you. Whenever you get inspired, how many of you, people actually say that sometimes, you know, during the Sutta class or during those Wednesday night talks, you get inspired, you get really nice, peaceful meditations. Why? It's because of inspiration. And you see what happens. Inspiration connected with the Dhamma, gladness, rapture. There's a rapture there somewhere, and your body becomes really tranquil. You sit here just so easy.
Is inspiration something to do with the present becoming very beautiful and pleasurable?
Inspiration is anything. It's obviously a Christian word. It means you're filled with the Holy Spirit. That's what inspiration actually means. But you know, we use it for many things. We're inspired by so many things. But that's its original meaning, very Christian word. But the idea of Veda is a Pali word. And again, because those Vedas were supposed to be inspiring to people, they read them and they got uplifted. So it is a type of happiness, delight. Yeah. Yes, okay.
So where does that delight come from? Is it an aspect of stillness that comes from inspiration?
I don't know. That's a difficult question. But I know it's there, and when you get inspired, you know that inspirational joy. It's something just, it hits the spot. It sort of resonates and it uplifts you. Anyway, so that's a very common causal sequence, and it actually shows you. Sometimes it goes even further, and in the Anguttara, for example, and other ones, it says, "And for when the mind becomes concentrated, when it gets samadhi, you will see things as they truly are, yathabhuta jnana dasana, as approximate cause. And then from seeing things as they truly are, the mind is liberated. When the mind is liberated, it knows it's liberated." So this is actually the way to enlightenment, another beautiful way. Inspired with the Dhamma, you get glad, you get rapture, body's still, feel beautiful, inner pleasure, you get into jhana, samadhi, see things as they truly are, then you're enlightened. Finished, done. Simple. But remember, inspired by the Dhamma. And that will only work, you'll only take that path if your cloth is perfectly clean. And that's the whole point of this. Now get your cloth nice and clean. Get all this silly stuff about ill will or anger or negligence or arrogance. Get that all the way. That's easy stuff. And then the mind takes a dive. You get so inspired when you hear the Dhamma because there's no defilements there. And then you're off.
All the defilements have to do with self. One defilement here that doesn't have directly to do with self.
Exactly.
So if you work on each of these defilements, you just go crazy. Too many. Because the next one is going to be worse.
Yeah, but sometimes the self is a very difficult thing for people to see at first. Or the illusion of self. So these ones, so people actually know these things. Ill will. They think you've got a self, you don't think you've got a self. You know, anger is.
But even temporarily, because these are only temporary.
That's right, yeah. So you get rid of them temporarily.
Same thing with yourself.
Yeah, well, you can do if you've got a lot of faith, but sometimes you talk about non-self and people don't get inspiration.
Yeah.
They get fear, they get upset. No, that's wrong. It can't be right. So,
I was stuck in my meditation this afternoon for 2.5 hours, and then I just gave up and I just said, I just sit there and do contemplation, so I'm just contemplating non-self.
Yeah, and then you go going again.
And then so a big wave of bliss comes from just nothing.
It does come, right? It comes from inspiration, gladness, rapture, and tranquility, and pleasure. That's where it comes from, cause and effect. So it's great.
Expected from something like that.
Yeah. No, I do. Oh, no, don't, no, I shouldn't. I shouldn't. I've made a big mistake there. Take that off the plate. You don't expect anything. But you do know cause and effect.
If there's stress and tension in the body, like the opposite of tranquility, is that an indicator that all these defilements are functioning, even if you're not really aware of them?
Either it's an indication that defilements are functional, or it could be that you're not getting the sort of the inspiration, not getting the gladness. Not sort of really, it's not biting. So that could be the case. So that's why sometimes you just get some inspiration in the Dhamma. You know, so inspiration in Anatta. That's beautiful. Inspiration.
I wasn't trying to get inspired.
Yeah, but like, it does. It's nice if you understand enough of it, it does inspire you.
I didn't understand until after.
Yeah, good. It's all very good. Now we've got the same with when you consider I am possessed of unwavering confidence in the Dhamma. Again, you gain inspiration in where that's going to lead, and inspiration in the Dhamma. You gain gladness connected with the Dhamma. When you're glad, the rapture is born in you. One is rapturous, the body becomes tranquil. One whose body is tranquil feels this beautiful sukha. And one who feels sukha, the mind becomes still, samadhi. You consider thus, I am possessed of unwavering confidence in the Sangha. And you gain inspiration in the, where it's going to lead to, inspiration in the Dharma, gain gladness connected with the Dharma. When you are glad, the rapture is born. And one who is rapturous, the body becomes still or peaceful. One whose body is peaceful feels the sukha, and the sukha leads to stillness of the mind in samadhi. You consider thus, the imperfections of the mind have in part been given up, expelled, released, abandoned, relinquished by me. And you gain inspiration even in that. The fact that you're getting somewhere, that some of these things have gone. And you're making progress. You get inspiration. You gain inspiration in the where it's going to lead, in the Dharma. You gain gladness connected with the Dharma. When you are glad, rapture is born in you. One who's rapturous feels tranquility in the body. One whose body is tranquil feels sukha. And one who feels sukha, the mind becomes still. Very, very beautiful. Now we have this little paragraph 12, which the introduction said this really should have become a bit further down. So I'm going to put this further down, where I think it should really belong, which is after number 18. It shouldn't be number 12 after 18. So paragraph 12 is now going to be omitted, and we're going to put it where it usually belongs, where it's in the Mahayana Suttas after paragraph 18. So now, you know, you've got here, the mind becomes still. Then now you abide pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with metta. Likewise the second quarter, the third, the fourth, that's east, south, north and west. So above, below, around and everywhere, and to all as to yourself. You know, now get compassion to other people, forget yourself. You abide pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with metta, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility, without ill will. Now, it's abundant, is think vipula, exalted, that's called mahagata. And because I know the Pali, and because when I got into the Vinaya, he said, oh, I know where that word comes from, that is a synonym for the jhanas. So they only use that word exalted there. If you knew your Pali, that is a flag saying this is not just ordinary metta, this is the metta which is taking you into a jhana state. Because that word mahagata, this comes from the fourth parajika. If any monk or bhikkhuni, if they claim one of these great states which they haven't got, then that's they have to disrobe, as they're lying about it. They know they're lying. And those states are called the jhanas or the enlightenment states, and the jhanas ones are called mahagata. The same word as exalted. So most of that, now these actually mean not just ordinary metta, this is taking the metta into the jhanas. The same with the other three, brahmaviharas. You abide pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with compassion. Likewise the second, the third, the fourth, so above, below, around, and everywhere, and to all as to yourself. Be compassionate to yourself. Above, pray for the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with karuna. Abundant, gone to jhana, immeasurable, without hostility, without ill will. And then you abide pervading the whole world one quarter with a mind imbued with altruistic joy, the second, the third, the fourth quarter, so above, below, around and everywhere, and to all as to yourself. You abide faith in the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with altruistic joy, abundant, gone to jhana, immeasurable, without hostility, without ill will. Then you abide pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with equanimity, likewise the second, the third, the fourth, so above, below, around and everywhere, and to all as to yourself. You abide faith in the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with equanimity, abundant, gone to jhana, immeasurable, without hostility, without ill will. So that's the four brahmaviharas, sometimes also called the four immeasurables. That's the apamana, the immeasurable states. So now that's in the suttas, they sometimes use that instead of the four jhanas. Now, you are just, yes?
In, I think it's the Amaravati chants.
Yeah.
They
chant.
Yes, yeah.
Is it a common chant?
It is not uncommon, but I must remember just one experience here. When Ajahn Chakka was here, but we used to chant there. And I remember I used to really get into it. We used to meditate first and then do the chanting.
That's lovely,
chant. Well, I can go further. When it started going, if you got some good meditation going, I remember once just in the metta, and you don't just chanting it, you're actually doing it as you're chanting it. Finding one quarter of the mind imbued with metta, the second quarter, the third quarter, above all, below, and word for yourself with mind. You just can go on, you're just full of so much metta, and just, and shut up, I'm just dissing out. After that, I said, look, this is too strong, could you do another chant?
So that's why you don't
understand. That's right, yeah. Personally, it's just too strong. You really get into that. Yeah. But if you do that, and you get into it, stop the chanting, because it's done its job. Enjoy it. This one over here, the four Brahmaviharas. You abide pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with loving kindness. A kang disang, dutiyang, tatiyang, chatutang. I forget exactly the chant now, but I used to know it by heart a long time ago. Now we have the Zen koan. Paragraph 17. You understand thus. There is this. There is the inferior. There is the superior. And beyond, there is an escape from this whole field of perception. With no explanation. Except that when you know and see thus, your mind is liberated from the outflowing of sensual desire, from the asava, the outflowing of being, and the outflowing of delusion. When it is liberated, there comes a knowledge. It is liberated. You understand, birth is destroyed. The whole life has been lived. And what had to be done has been done. There's no more coming to any state of being. Now, I won't say the last little saying there. So, if you really understood what that meant, when you know and see thus, your mind is liberated. You're an arahat. So have a look at that again. Anyone understand it? Anyone want to be an arahat this evening? So it's one of these very deep ones. But obviously, you have to do it in order, first of all. In other words, you have to get rid of all those defilements. Then you have to get unwavering confidence in the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha. Then, considering those things, you get this wonderful sequence of inspiration, gladness, rapture, tranquility of the body and mind, sukha and samadhi, jhanas. And then you can pervade the whole world with these wonderful four Brahmaviharas. Then you will know what this means. There is this, there is inferior, there is superior. Beyond this, escape from this whole field of perception. Which is why it's a waste of time trying to figure out what that means. It's good fun, isn't it? And so many people have their idea of what it means. And in the commentary in the back, where it says that this means dukkha, the inferior means the origin of dukkha, the superior means the end of dukkha, beyond is the path into the escape, or something like that. And other people say there is this means the experience you have right now, and there is the inferior to this experience. It can be worse, it can be better. And or you can even say that there is this human realm, there is the inferior lower realms, there is the higher realms, and beyond there is an escape from all of these realms. So whatever you want, the escape from the whole field of perception, that is pretty obvious. The escape from the whole field of perception. No more perception at all. That's the end of all perception. With the end of all perception, that's the end of all consciousness. The end of all feeling. The end of all mind. Because where there's a mind, there has to be perception. So, the escape from the whole field of perception must be the end of the mind. Da da da. Yeah, some people will delight in that, some people will not delight in that, depending on whether your cloth is pure.
To really allow for that to happen, there has to be a very different, or a very profound and different kind of understanding of what perception is to the ordinary sort of mind.
That's a very good point. You have to have a very deep understanding of perception. And there's a good chance you might have done that because you've just done these jhanas, especially with the Brahmavihara jhanas. And that's, again, that's really sort of bending your perception all over the place. To places where you've never been before. So what you see, what you experience is nothing like you've ever known before. So you're really experimenting with the different types of perception. Yes, Richard.
How linear is this teaching? Because it's kind of like abandon the defilements and then get sotapanna and then get the jhanas and then do the brahmaviharas. It seems like, you know, like the brahmaviharas are used for abandoning the defilements. It, you know, so it's more like circular.
Yeah, it's a bit linear, but it's not totally linear. Just like any journey, you know, you go on a journey, yeah, it's a straight road between here and Perth, but you can drop off at the hardware store on the way, or drop off at the internet cafe, drop off at Subway to pick up something for lunch. So, you know, you take some back roads and you go round and round sometimes, but, you know, it's pretty much a straight journey.
Is there nothing to worry about, Ajahn?
Of course not. So don't worry about anything. Some Buddha must have been in Australia. No worries.
Because, you know, I guess if you come back to the idea or the understanding that it's a natural process, then even though there's a lot of things which is outside the experience for some of us, you can just sort of trust that things unfold.
Indeed, that's that trust. If you really trust, as things said on the Wednesday night talk, oh, you weren't here on Wednesday night, were you? Yeah, you was, that's right, yeah, you were. The trust gives you another talk I gave. The trust allows you to let go. If you don't trust, you have fear. Or fear is actually what stops you trusting. And once you sort of have fear, you have control. So it's a beautiful sense of like trusting in the process. So you just sit here and you do nothing because you trust that it's all going to work out sooner or later. Allows you to let go. If you don't trust, I gave this image just like a baby trusts its mother so much. The mother can be holding the baby in one hand, a shopping cart in the other, going through the shopping malls, maybe listening to her mobile phone at the same time, and the baby just goes to sleep in the mother's arms. And if that baby had any sense, it'd be paranoid. He'd be dropped at any moment. And that mother, I mean, just how can you trust a mother when she's in a shopping centre talking to her friend on the mobile phone? And all sorts of stuff. If the baby had any sense, we'd never be able to go to sleep. If I was being carried, if you were carrying me to the shopping centre, I'd be just paranoid, especially in my weight. But the baby has so much trust in the mother, you can just go to sleep. Okay.
So trust is the asset,
yeah? Yeah. But it's a tough one because sometimes, you know, what are you going to trust? Many of you, you've trusted people and they've let you down.
Yeah. So, the
baby's
never been dropped yet.
Yeah, okay, the baby's been dropped. Never going to sleep. Anyway, okay. So after you've known and seen us, that's the standard. Your mind is liberated from these outflowings. And what causes the mind to go out? So looking for fun in the five senses, or just wanting to exist, the outflowing which is caused by just wanting to be. And of course that's what happens sometimes, you know, you just, especially to meditate, you should disappear, you don't exist anymore. And suddenly you just want to show people, I'm still here. And show yourself you're still here, and just do something. And lastly, the outflowing of delusion.
Sorry?
Forget it now, I'll just say, was it something profound?
No.
That's right, you always want to, you do something because you want to be somebody. It's just wanting to be.
Yeah.
You have to disturb everything.
So Ajahn, for that to make someone feel they exist, there has to be that identity with the doing.
The doer, yeah, that's right, yeah. The doer creates the self.
Or is it that a holy one does something, it's just the process?
That's right, yeah. Remember that great saying, to do is to be, Jean-Paul Sartre. No, to do is to be, Descartes. To be is to do, Jean-Paul Sartre. Do be, Frank Sinatra. Old joke. Anyway, goes back to serious. Now we go to paragraph 12. So, monks, if a monk of such virtue, such a state of samadhi, such wisdom, in other words, enlightenment, should have come after paragraph 18, as it does in the Mahayana. If they eat alms food consisting of choice hill rice, along with various sauces and curries, that was obviously, you know, that was the fish and chips and mushy peas at that time, or what else do you like, or the mama noodles of that time, or the vegetable soup which the Anagarikas make at that time. So if an Anagarika of such virtue, such a state of samadhi, such wisdom, eats alms food consisting of choice vegetables along with various, what else do you like? With various kimchi and seaweed. Even that will be no obstacle for you. Just as a cloth that is defiled and stained becomes pure and bright with the help of clear water, or just as gold becomes pure and bright with the help of a furnace, so too, if a monk of such virtue eats, you know, delicious alms food, that would be no obstacle for you. So that's the whole purpose of the sutta, from the argamas. This Brahmin, Sundarika Brahmavaja, thought the Buddha and all these monks were hopeless because they ate too good food, and the Buddha actually talks about the simile of a cloth and how, you know, the envy which, or the conceit which that Brahmin had, you know, was part of that simile. But if you follow this simile, then you become an arahat, and then it doesn't matter what you eat. So thereby he was actually talking about the Bharadwaja's problems there. It makes the whole thing makes more sense. Because now it says on paragraph 19, now on that occasion a Brahmin Sundarika Bharadwaja was sitting not far from the Blessed One. And it's actually all the time he was sitting there. So having got some, being oppressed by the Buddha, he asked him the questions. But does Master Gotama go to the Bahuka River to bathe? Because he obviously thought the Buddha was enlightened, very wise. And so, you know, usually in India, to become enlightened, you have to go to the rivers to bathe. Why, Brahmin, go to the Bahuka River? What can a Bahuka River do? Master Gotama, the Bahuka River is held by many to give liberation. It is held by many to give merit, and many wash away their evil actions in the Bahuka River. This is like India in that time. They still do that. They go and wash in the Ganges. Over in London, they wash in the Thames. No, they don't. it's actually the Ganges is here afterwards. Is it? No, actually they don't. That was another river, but they were really into the rivers in those days. Then the Blessed One addressed the Brahmin Sundarika Bharadwajas in stanzas. Bahuka and Adikaka, Gaya and Sundarika too, Payaga and Sarasati and the stream Bahumati. A fool may there forever bathe, yet will not purify dark deeds. What can a Sundarika bring to pass? What the Payaga, what the Bahuka? They cannot purify an evildoer, a man who has done cruel and brutal deeds. One pure in mind and pure in heart has evermore the feast of spring, the holy day. One fair in act, one pure in heart, brings his virtue to perfection. It is here, Brahmin, that you should bathe, to make yourself a refuge for all beings. And if you speak no falsehood, nor work harm for living beings, not take what is offered not, with faith and free from avarice, what need for you to go to Gaya? For any well will be your Gaya. So yes, going in, obviously you see that was a local idea at the time. In these days, you might say, what is the need to sort of go to church? Or to go to the mosque, or go to somewhere to be purified, or go to the confessional booth? Just, if you speak no falsehood, nor work harm for living beings, nor take what is offered not to you, with faith and free from avarice, what need for you to go to a temple or a church? For any well would be your church. It's quite nice. Yeah. Avarice in Pali, I'm not quite sure
what the word English
All the avarice is like just wanting things.
Okay.
What do you accumulate?
I'm just wondering, like, the Buddha, do you think the Buddha actually spoke in the poem?
Oh, yeah, that was, 'cause that was the done thing at that time.
Oh, like a popular thing?
Yes, right, yeah. That's very interesting. That means just like empty songs. But remember, this was almost like entertainment poems.
Like what you do when you tell jokes.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, as long as there's something to do with Dhamma, sometimes they're not, I must agree. But in those days, they would have poetry, and sometimes you wonder about, say, some of the Dhamma songs coming out of, you know, places like Malaysia or Singapore. You know, are they appropriate? And this is actually how they would do it in times of the Buddha. They would have actually gathas. And gathas, these verses, they were meant to be sung. Gatha and Gita, it's just they're connected again, to be sung.
Did the
Buddha sing? I don't think so, but there's a chanting. The chant would have a melody to it, because they had, you know, the passing of the verses, had a sort of rhyme to it. In the English, you can't do it. But you know, it's da 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 da. You know, it had a rhyme to it, which was made it very easy to put to some sort of music, or just like, you know, the Gregorian chants. They're just chants. They're very beautiful. And actually, we had the Benedictine monks up here, and they asked us to do our chanting. And I was very embarrassed, because, you know, the Benedictine Christian monks, their chanting is actually sort of beautiful, and they actually practice it. You know, we just, you know, just get by. You know what our chanting is like. But, you know, you're right in the middle of it. But they were sitting at the back in this hall. They said, that's really beautiful chanting. They were inspired by it. I thought, you know, they must be all deaf or something. But it happened to me one day. You know, we were doing the chanting. I had to leave, you know, to actually go to an appointment. I actually walked out and heard everybody else do the chanting. It actually sounds very good. It sounds much better when you're actually outside the group than when you're actually right inside. It does. So, yeah.
What determines when the Buddha, what determines when the Buddha decides, okay, I'm going to chant this in a lower tune? Like, I heard, like, in Udana, it's kind of to inspire people.
That's right.
To get that faith and inspiration and all that.
Yes, because this was a Brahmin. He was. You know, into sort of obviously verses and stuff, so it's probably, you know, trying to inspire the Brahmin.
And then speak his language?
That's right, speak his language, speak in the form which he was probably used to. That's my supposition.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, at the end of that, it obviously worked, because when this was said, the Brahmin, Sundarika Bharadwaja, said, "Magnificent Master Gotama, magnificent Master Gotama, Master Gotama has made the Dharma clear in many ways, as they who were totally upright would have been overthrown, revealing what was hidden, showing the way to one who was lost, or holding up a lamp in the dark for those with eyesight to see forms. I go to Master Gotama for refuge, and to the Dhamma, and to the Sangha of Bhikkhus, the three refuges. Now he went a bit further. I'd received the going forth under Master Gotama. I would receive the full admission. The going forth was Samanera, full admission as Bhikkhu." So, you know, he went that bit further. He said, yep, this is it, I want to ordain. And the Brahmin Sundarika Bharadwaja received the going forth under the Blessed One, and he received the full admission, that's the higher ordination. And soon, not long after his ordination as a bhikkhu, dwelling alone, withdrawn, diligent, ardent and resolute, the Venerable Bharadwaja, by realizing for himself with direct knowledge, here and now entered upon abiding that supreme goal of the holy life, for the sake of which clansmen and clanswomen rightly go forth from the home life into homelessness. He directly knew, birth is destroyed, the holy life has been lived, and what had to be done has been done. There is no more coming to any state of being. And the Venerable Bharadwaja became one of the arahats. Now, you see, so he went forth, and it says here, and not long after his full admission. Now, you see that in other monks, you know, they say not long after, and sometimes you read their stories in the Theragata, and it actually says what it means. It usually means 20 or 30 years. So please have confidence and hope, because you know, and when you think about all the eons of existence, you've travelled around samsara, 20 or 30 years being a monk or a nun is no long time. Exactly, he knows that. So that's no long time, doesn't mean you become a bhikkhu or you become a nun and then next week you're enlightened. It does take a bit of time. So that's what it says. So what it says, but important, not long after his Buddha mission, dwelling alone. Now remember, that's the first part of this. So he spent lots of time in solitude. It didn't mean that he was totally alone as a hermit all those 20, 30 years, because all monks, at least, even the ones who are very senior, have to come once a fortnight for the Patimokkha, which we do tomorrow. It means you spend a lot of time in solitude. You don't hang out with each other. Withdrawn. Again, withdrawn physically and also mentally. Withdrawing your senses. Diligent. Not sleeping too much. Ardent and resolute. So that's what you have to do. And the more those are strong, the less time it takes. And then, he now enters the Bodhabodhi, the supreme goal of the holy life. For why we go forth? You don't know. Birth is destroyed. Finished. And became another one of the arahants. So it's easy. That's how it's done. Any comments or questions before we finish off for the night?
It sounds like the last four of the arahants that they mentioned, you assumed it.
Yeah.
Mana,
that's right. The
last four.
Especially Atimana, because according to most times in the suttas, the Brahmins were very, very arrogant, conceited. They were the highest class. Yes?
How complete is the Adhimacana in regards to the
Charitas? It is very, very, very similar. They've got some more suttas in there which aren't in the Pali, but it's pretty sort of almost exactly the same. There is a book which I think is in the library now by Bhikkhu Anālaya, the comparative study of the Majjhima Nikāya, this one here, and the Majjhima Agama. So the work has been done, it's continued to be done, and it's quite instructive. And this is actually one, this particular Vatupama Sutta, it's so helpful, because when you see the Agamas and you add it to this, the whole thing becomes far more understandable. Yeah. Yeah, well, this is again one of the reasons we do 10 suttas here is because you see the different ways the Buddha taught from different people. And you know, the 2 weeks' time we get Sammaditti Sutta on right view. So it's giving you like a taste of how the Buddha taught. And of course, he would not teach in the sense of like this is a Dhamma, he would teach according to the people, according to their needs. So the case of this particular sutta was especially for that Sundarika Bhardwaja. So he managed to get a sutta which talk about right view, wouldn't have cut any ice with that sort of Brahmin. He said, I've got right view, you've got wrong view. So he had to have a skillful discourse which would eventually lead to right view, but to begin with just talk about defilements, and especially how when you overcome those defilements and do all these other practices, you can eat whatever food you like.
The beautiful thing about the sutta that I might interject at this point.
Of course you may interject.
Yeah. Is that all these defilements, it's a pretty revolutionary idea if you really look at it.
Mm.
To think that you can actually get rid of your defilements.
Mm.
That the Buddha said we can actually get rid of our defilements. For example, Western culture, like anger, ill will, that everyone accepts those things. They don't even try to get rid of them.
Yeah, you express them.
Yeah, you express them.
You try to get rid of them, that's the prison.
You can actually get rid of these things, this revolution.
Yep.
There's a like one thing, like in our society, like they assume there's no function for different states of mind. Like at university, you're taught that whether you have compassion or anger or jealousy, it has no function. Like consciousness is kind of like smoke and fire and phenomena. So in these Buddhist teachings, it's quite revolutionary. Like, oh, that either, you know, these things are to be kept and these things are to be abandoned, and they have consequences.
That's right. In the conference I went to a couple of weeks ago, the psychologist, they asked me that question. If you get rid of anger and greed and lust, then, you know, these things have an evolutionary purpose. You know, the lust, the evolutionary purpose of keeping the progress of the species. So I said, what's the evolutionary purpose of getting rid of the defilements? I said, this is the end of evolution. This is its pinnacle. This is where evolution is supposed to end. The devolution, yeah. So, the arahats, male and female, we are the pinnacle, the acme of evolution. This is where it all is supposed to lead to an end.
And what they're propagating now can...
Yeah, propagating delusion.
What they're propagating in the very highest intellectual circles, Buddhist or not, which happens in spirituality, is that we're evolving to much higher consciousness than the Buddha had, and all those, but they're just left behind now. Mm. And we're getting further and further and better, and leaving all that other stuff behind. It's madness.
Madness, yes. Anyway, evolution stops here.
Psychologists say that.
They laughed. They thought it was a very cute idea. Yeah. Yeah, well, they hadn't heard it before because always said evolution keeps on going. So it has an end. This is it.
Now let us express our approval of this Dhamma teaching.
Sadhu, 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 anumodami.
Very good. Okay.
Arahaṃ sammā sambuddho bhagavā Buddhaṃ bhagavantaṃ abhivādhayami.